Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
In the spotlight is TV and movie writer, producer, executive producer, and creator Dean Hargrove. He has been writing and creating television series since 1961 when he became a staff writer on the first Bob Newhart show. I think I've seen every episode of that show. I've watched it all the time. He became the sole staff writer on The Man from U.N.C.L.E., another series that I watched assiduously. And wrote the screenplay for the pilot Columbo. You get the idea here. We're going through some of these credits, and I've watched all of them. And you listeners, I'm sure you've listened to a lot of them. There's more to come here. Thereafter, he created and produced Matlock, Jake and the Fat Man, Father Dowling Mysteries, McBride, Jane Doe, and Murder 101. He wrote and produced 33 Perry Mason movies, executive produced series and TV movies in the United Kingdom, Italy, and Brazil. Add to those programs such as My Three Sons, Diagnosis Murder, It Takes a Thief, The Name of the Game, McCoy, Dear Detective, Return to Mayberry, McLeod, starring Dennis Weaver in his cowboy hat and his, I forget if it was a 38 or a 45, but a formidable character there, like many of the characters that Dean Hargrove created. And he's not done. Dean Hargrove is currently developing a radio podcast series titled The Trials of Johnny Cochran, the famous civil rights attorney and defender of O.J. Simpson during his murder case, as well as a potential British TV series titled The Trials of Joan of Arc. From a small town in Kansas to Hollywood, California, Dean Hargrove, thank you for coming on the program.
Oh, I'm very flattered you're talking to me. People don't really care that much about writers, as it turns out. So I think you're doing a great service.
Well, you know, the thing is that your name is not one that people necessarily know, but your work, and not only do they know your work, but they have spent, I think most people have spent, especially people of my age category and even a lot younger, have spent many hours entertained by the work you and your comrades did. Let's go back in time, because we do like to talk about writing, and I've never had a TV writer on the program before. When did you start writing and why? How old were you when you figured out that you really enjoyed being a wordsmith?
Well, it's really when I was in college. My mother had ideas and admiration for writers. She was an inveterate reader, and she did a lot of sort of writing for herself at the time. And so there were always a lot of books at my house. Many times when we were there, when my father was out traveling on business, we'd sit at the table, and when I was even 9, 10, and we'd each have our book. And she said, someday, some woman is going to hate you for letting you do this during dinner. My real ambition was to be in the movie business. In the little town where I came from, which was Iola, Kansas, a very pretty and nice town in those days, the people that I saw living on the screen were so much better off and having a better time than I was. I said, I'd really like to be there. So when I went to the University of Wichita, which is our Wichita State, I tried to take courses that would help me do that. I worked on varsity shows and whatever I could do. I made some student films, which were very haphazard because there really wasn't a film school there, and people weren't going to film schools because there weren't that many. So that's kind of where it was. I had a lot of help at the university with people in the English department. My mother was the executive secretary to the head of the political science department, which turned out to be my final major while I was there.
So this little town that you grew up in was near Wichita State.
Well, in terms that most people would think of, it was very close, because for us, that was a long time, long space in between.
What do you mean by a long space in between? Long distance?
No, it really wasn't that long. But in Kansas, everything seems to be a long distance because there's not that much there between towns.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If it was out here, they'd say, well, it was just out in Claremont. But over there was over 100 miles, which seemed like a very far distance to us.
Right. I should tell our listeners that Dean Hargrove lives in Brentwood, California, out there on the west side, the Hollywood, where a lot of Hollywood people live, TV and Hollywood type people. So that kind of explains you're seeing movies, you're seeing TV shows, you're seeing movies, and that kind of explains why you decided you wanted to write television or movies rather than books. Even though your mom was an inveterate reader, right? She read mystery after mystery. Is that right?
Oh, that's correct. Always. Yeah. We had many boxes full of paperback books.
Did you ever think back? I mean, during your career, you've had this long and storied career. Did you ever at any point decide, I really want to write a novel because I want total control over it and not have to deal with the talent involved in the studio and whatnot?
Well, I'd thought about it, but I was always afraid that I didn't have a sufficient literary style or to do anything novelistic. So I was intimidated by that. And fortunately, I was always busy, so I didn't have time to trouble myself with it. Except finally, when I was at my last studio assignment working for Sony International Television, where I was the executive producer on movies and some series for the BBC that Sony had underwritten the deficit financing, I thought, well, one afternoon I was in my hotel suite and I thought, baseball's been good to me. I can't complain about anything, but this isn't really why I went to film school. So I decided, well, maybe I could do a short film and finance it myself. So the next day I had an idea just out of nowhere. I thought, well, there's two kinds of tap dancing. There's a tap dancing that everybody remembers from the MGM movies. And then there's a tap dancing today, which is much more, innovative and has a lot of hip hop mixed into it. And so I thought, well, maybe I could do a short film on that. So I started doing it, and it turned out as it was very well received. And then I decided a few years later, when I had a break in my schedule, I'm going to do a documentary film on tap around the world, because it's now traveled a great deal. And there's communities of tap dancers in a lot of unseemly places. So I worked with two sisters who were entrepreneurial tap dancers named Chloe and Maud Arnold, and they're very iconic in the community. And we set out and we did this thing called Tap World. And actually, it's one of the things I'm most proud of that I've done in my lifetime. And I would be thrilled if people would go to Netflix and search for it and take a look at it. It's only about 80 minutes, and it's very entertaining in my mind. And I got nice reviews, and it's kind of the culmination of what I've done. And then because we had a strike and other things have gone on, I decided to do a documentary. So I connected with a politician in San Francisco named Willie Brown,
who's very famous,
very colorful and brilliant guy. And I've spent the last 20 years trying to get something done with her work. At the moment, we have a first cut, but because of the pandemic, we lost the rest of our financing. So I'm out now trying to hustle up the rest of the money to get it done. And of course, I have the thing with Johnny Cochran, which I have what appears to be serious interest in getting that done. And after that goes, I want to do a documentary on tap women, because women play such a large part in tap dancing, and so many young girls have taken tap lessons in their lifetime, and some of them on to great success.
But as one but of you my, have You have the TAP project you did during the pandemic is on Netflix now.
Yes, it is. It was. Last time I looked, it was there. They're not paying me anymore, but it's out there.
They don't like to pay anybody that they don't have to, as you know.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, I want to go back to your college years for a second, because you went to Wichita State University. You also went to UCLA Film School. First of all, at Wichita State University, what was your major?
Well, they didn't have a film department. And so the major they had, it sort of covered this, which really was teaching radio. It was called the speech department.
So
to take the radio courses, that was technically my major, which dismayed my father, who was always very skeptical of my doing anything in show business. And he said, well, what are you going to do when you get this degree? Put up a sign that says speaker?
And typical cynical father, huh?
Oh, yeah. This he couldn't figure that. He could never quite figure out if I was going to be able to make a living, you know, as a writer in Hollywood. His favorite story that he always told as sort of a joke, but recurred many times. He said, father's at home and he hears a scratching at the door. And he goes and he opens the middle of the night and there's his son. And he says, father, I've come home to die. He said, no, you haven't. You've come home to eat.
So you're, well, his misgivings are well founded, because so many people try to get into the profession and never really make any scratch at it. Now, so you go to UCLA Film School as a graduate school to learn film. You're still thinking of making movies at this time, is that right?
Well, yeah, that was the whole idea. You know, I mean, to write a movie, of course, is the center of the project of what you're doing.
What was your experience like at UCLA Film School?
Well, it was very interesting because there were two schools to choose from at that time. One was USC and the other was UCLA. Now, I didn't really know anything about USC, but I had heard of it, UCLA. So I applied and I was admitted to their program. But in those days, UCLA, through the Board of Regents, had an attitude that they didn't want their students contaminated by the film business. So there wasn't any real connection to the industry as there was at SC. Everybody at SC was getting jobs right away, although I had two very distinguished fellow students there, one being Francis Coppola and the other one Bogdanovich, who went on to really great success.
They were at UCLA with you or at SC?
Yeah, no, they were at UCLA. It was kind of surprising, except that UCLA had the best archives of either of the two schools. USC didn't have a great archival system. They just had people who got jobs. UCLA had a great archives, and I got to see early Russian films or German films that were all totally new to me. I had no clue. And I found that very helpful from an educational standpoint. Unfortunately, one day I looked to try to see, where does everybody go after they're at UCLA? And I saw they were making commercials and industrials. And I started looking into the program a little more closely. And it was such an adjunct to the theater department. They had old Quonset houses from World War II. And they had their equipment was rather primitive. their equipment was rather primitive. And the faculty there was... Some of them were quite good, and some of them weren't as impressive as others. So I stayed there, and I looked at some of the, I got these courses I was taking. And I remember I had a camera professor, and one of our, they had old Aeroflexes and things like that. So it was to go out and shoot the construction at they had old Aeroflex cameras, and our assignment mainly was to go out and shoot construction around the university. UCLA is still expanding, as I'm sure you probably know. So anyway, I went out and I shot a lot of stuff, and I made these student films. They weren't even student films. They were films I made while I was a student, because nobody was teaching me anything. And so I'd had some experience just in the practical sense. So I was cutting in the camera, and he came out and watched me, and he said, this is never going to work. This will never cut together. But I was cutting in the camera, so when I showed it to him, he was sort of impressed this hadn't occurred to him that it might. And then one day, so he kind of liked me for that. And he was a very bookish kind of fellow. And so one day I came in and he said, "I just got my big break." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I think it would be a contract at MGM or something." He said, "I've gotten a grant to do a film on the housefly."
The housefly.
So I thought, maybe this really isn't the place for me. And fortunately, I had written some sketch material because I wanted to be a comedy writer. And I showed it to a girl I knew there, introduced me to a guy who was part of a writing team on Make Room for Daddy with Danny Thomas. The band she introduced me to was a comedy writer, part of a team for a show called Make Room for Daddy, which Danny Thomas was the star. It was a very good show. It was a very funny show. So he agreed to meet with me. And so I go over to his house and he's talking to me. He's a very dour fellow, as many comedy writers are. And he said, "Well, what have you written?" I said, "Well, nothing." He said, "Well, why don't you write something?" This was a revelation to me. So I went home that evening and I, over the weekend, I wrote some sketch material, which I took back to him. And he starts reading it. And comedy writers many times will do that. They'll read something, they'll say, "That's funny. That's very funny. That's okay. That's funny." So I'm sitting there waiting for him to finish. And he says, "Well, this is what passes for very good in Hollywood." Now, all I heard was "very good." But on the way home, I'm saying "passes for very good in Hollywood." And anyway, then it was encouraging enough that I took this material and through some weird set of circumstances, I met up with a comedian named Bill Dana, who in those days was doing Jose Jimenez, which politics at the time, he had to eliminate the character at one point as being racist. But he gave me $500 to do the B-side of an album doing just this material that I had. And this was my first real job. I mean, I was figuring out, well, this is going to be, you know, sunshine from here on. And so I worked on this thing, but he had me work with another experienced writer. And then he says to me one day, "I'm going back to Chicago to meet with Steve Allen. He's doing a new show on ABC, and I want to present you to bring you on the show."
Let me ask you, for the person who wants to be the next Dean Hargrove or David Kelly, or Francis Coppola, is UCLA film school, a formal education in film school, necessary, or has that changed, or was it never really necessary?
Well, I don't know that it's necessary. It's sort of like law schools that churn out lawyers that don't have jobs waiting for them. I mean, the University of Rome turns out thousands of attorneys, but none of them have work because law firms there are just little studios. It's kind of magnified over here. So it's very tough, you know, to get somebody to pay attention to you. So people always have to look for back doors to go in, and whether they went to school or not really doesn't matter. I mean, you have to know, or you have to figure out what you're doing. I think it's helpful to have that because particularly for your own aesthetic, you need to be exposed to all kinds of films. Or television shows. Television you can see on your own. Personally, I don't think that it's necessary to do that. There are a lot of filmmakers, you know, talk to Quentin Tarantino. His film school was a video store. You know, I mean, that's not to say that it wouldn't help you, but I don't find it a necessity.
So true or false, we are living in the golden age of television.
I think that's a very interesting question because that comes up every once in a while. And somebody's asked me that, and they say, well, the 70s were the golden age of television. I say, well, in some sense, they were. Today's films are much more sophisticated. Everything is better, I think. Not necessarily the writing, but in some cases it is. And I thought about that a lot. And I said, well, why do they say that about the 70s? And when they say that, my theory is that if you look at the shows from the 70s, most of the time, the show was the name of the character. Columbo, Rockford Files, Starsky and Hutch. You go down the list. You don't have that today. They're not as driven by character. They're driven by mechanics. And also the hardest thing to get somebody to do in television is watch your show, just to get introduced to the show you're doing. So what they do now is they're taking all kinds of formulaic ideas and turning them inside out. We've got a black cop and a white girl and a Mexican girl with a white guy and a black. You have all these permutations, and they're doing anything that sounds interesting. So the show may not have any legs at all, but they get somebody to watch it. And anyway, that's
and it might or might not catch on. But would you agree that today the shows tend to be more ensemble than lead character?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
they have to do something to give it some kind of dimension, you know, because otherwise, why ain't anybody going to turn it on? And a lot of these ideas, as you were just pointing out, they don't have legs. I mean, they go on and they're off. And people say, well, there's so much more television today. Well, that's not actually true. When I started in television, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was 36 episodes a season. You now have shows that come on for 6 episodes a season, and then they don't come back. But if you're driving around Los Angeles, there's so many billboards, you say, well, you're not going to have time to watch all these shows. But it turns out you will. And there's some great shows now. I'm not diminishing what's going on now, but I just think in general, there are things about both eras. You know, films are more sophisticated. They don't have the restrictions of censorship that they did. You know,
that's a big one right there, don't you think? Because you couldn't really make, I mean, if you wanted to do a mob series, you couldn't make it authentic because mobsters don't talk in clean language. But you weren't allowed to use profanity until the paid channels came along, the streaming channels. And it was kind of like, well, these are for adults, and you know, we're not under the strictures of ABC, CBS, Fox, and so on. So would you say golden age of television is today, or was it the 70s?
Well, I think there are elements of both. I mean, certainly there's more sophistication in television today. But I think the problem with television today and why so many of these shows don't make it, and you know, some of them do, and some of them are terrific, but it's the fact the 70s had character shows. That's where you started with Kojak or Columbo, and you know. And I think that's the center of any show is the character. I mean, it's if they hook into the character, that's it. If you watch Columbo, what's that show about? Well, the formula is okay. It's not a bad idea. The two guys who created the show, Levinson and Link, you know, that was Crime and Punishment. That's where they took the idea. And it was very clever. And the character, as embodied by Peter Falk, was endearing. And, you know, it's like in Italy, when the show was on, they'd stop movies in the middle of the movie and put up the television show, Columbo. I mean, it was a fantastic international success. And it's hard to find anybody that hasn't seen an episode of that show. It's still playing now.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, people, you can just mention Columbo just as a point of reference and people know. And it was definitely a very well watched television series. Let me ask you about how did you practice the craft of writing when you knew you wanted to be a writer? What did you do to practice your craft? Did you do anything formal? Did you do anything in terms of you sat down every day and practiced for X amount of time? And what was the nature of that practice? How did you actually become a writer, develop your writing skills?
Well, at university, I made the most progress in trying to become a disciplined writer. I mean, my second major was English. And I had a couple of very good teachers there and who liked what I was doing. And they were extremely encouraging to me. So that gave me the impetus to keep doing it. You know, I'm still spending a certain amount of time on my studies, not as much as I could get away with anyway. And then my last major was political science, which is the course that I love the most.
Uh-huh. You know, Wikipedia says you, meaning you, Dean Hargrove, has specialized in creating mystery series. Any dispute with that characterization?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've done lots of different kinds of shows, but it wasn't my special. That sort of infers that's what I did, you know, and I did most of the shows, you know, have some kind of melodramatic dimension to them. But like I did a show called Madigan with Richard Widmark. I did a con show with Tony Curtis called McCoy. So, and I did Perry Mason, which was already developed. I just took it and put it into a more contemporary form. And there's another example of the name, the character. That's what that show is. It was a very convoluted mystery. I never liked the show in the beginning of the 60s. I never watched it because it was all these, you know, convoluted, you know, highly convenient things that happened in them that I just had a problem with. I don't like mysteries per se. I like suspense. My favorite Hitchcock is my director, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's, no, that's
not a bad touchstone there.
Oh. And I've seen, I think, literally all of his films. I have everyone that's ever been on a DVD. I mean, they're a study. You know?
What's your favorite?
Which one?
This Hitchcock. Movie?
Two. Strangers on a Train and North by Northwest.
Oh, wow. You're making a point, though. You studied Hitchcock, or there was a course about his suspense
writing?
Well,
I studied it in as much as I'd seen all of them. And then once they started turning them out in DVDs, you know, and you know, videotapes, then I caught up. I have stuff going back to his silent films from England. No, he's a master, or was certainly.
Yeah.
And it's a great formula.
Yeah.
Innocent man unjustly accused, you know, the police are after him and the bad guys are after him. You know, it's a genius. Yeah.
You know, Wikipedia also says you worked frequently with television producer Fred Silverman and television writer Joel Steiger. Talk about Fred Silverman. I've seen his name on so many TV shows in the credits.
Well, I started working with Fred in 1985, and we worked together for about 10 years. And we had a great run because Fred had just come off being, he was head of all three networks at one point. The last network he was on, he wasn't as successful. The other two, of which he was a blazing success, didn't go well. And ultimately, you know, he was replaced by a guy named Grant Tinker, who's a very sophisticated gentleman and beloved by many, many people. Fred wasn't necessarily beloved. Fred was a character. There are so many stories about Fred Silverman that everybody's got one, whoever worked with him. And
so very colorful, huh?
Oh, very, very colorful and a real character. But he had one thing. He had an innate sense of an audience. You know, he just had this thing that he knew when something was really going to work. And on that basis, he totally turned CBS around, took away all the, you know, the rural programming like, you know, Andy Griffith and things like that, and brought in All in the Family. You know, when he was at NBC, he saw the pilot for Hill Street Blues, and he said, that's on the air. One of the...
So he had an instinct for what the viewing public was really going to have an affinity for.
And he's the thing with the stuff that we did, his genius was that he said, you know, there are a lot of guys around, I think, still have a series in them. So, and he said, most of the time in his history, when things got fucked up, Fred would, he said, you know, there are a lot of people around, Fred Silverman told me, that have another series in them. And most of the time when things get screwed up in developing a show, it's the casting. Because in those days, it was very formalized in terms of when you made pilots, when they back to sell them, and when they went on the air. So at a certain point in that span of time, everybody's looking for the same guy or the same woman. And so it got screwed up because they put somebody, it was a compromise. And a lot of these pilots didn't work because of that. So his idea was, let's take people, stars, who are very welcome in homes and take what they do, which is comedy. If you look at the shows we cast in it, and let's devise a different kind of format for them. And I know you've done Columbo, this and that. So let's put them in a mystery. And so that's what we did. Perry Mason was already done, but in Matlock, for example, they tried to devise a show for him. And unfortunately, the writer and Fred, for some reason, just didn't work. So done Perry Mason, and Fred says, well, I vowed I'd never work for this company again. He said, but I'd like for you to come in and exec produce his show. So I took the name Matlock, which my old collaborator had used in a movie once and I always liked. And I went down and I looked up big time Murder One defense attorneys. because I wanted to be a colorful, you know, kind of country guy. And there was a journey, there was an attorney in Texas named Percy Foreman, who never lost a murder case, ever. He was a real genius. And so I found all this great material from him and a guy named Racehorse Haynes. And there was another guy up in the West whose name I can't remember at the moment. And so I just took their kind of material and I used that as the character. And we put it on. And this, again, is part of what my thesis about character. You know, some episodes and series you get out now, if they're a big success, they could run 4 or 5 years. We did 198 episodes at Matlock. Mm-hmm. He was just welcome in their home, and they just couldn't get up. The only knock on these shows were that they were old skewing, and network sales departments hated the shows, but they couldn't get rid of them because they got such big household numbers, the demographics they were looking for. There was some of them in there anyway, and if you took it off and you put something else in, it might have any. So they kept it doing until finally CBS says, well, we just can't keep making Diagnosis Murder. And we'd done 200 episodes. So we got to let it go, and which they did. But
so your career started with Bob Newhart, but My Three Sons was another show I watched starring Fred McMurray as the dad and his three sons there, Chip and I forget the others. But the My Three Sons was also very early in your career, correct?
Very, yeah. Yeah.
So those were a couple of your first credits, but you talk about characters, you've written about a lot of characters. What are the keys to creating a great character?
I don't know. I mean,
you do it over and over. Is it just kind of gut instinct?
Those weren't so great.
Well, you obviously have a gut instinct for it, but if somebody said, how do you do it? You don't necessarily have a methodology for creating or characteristics of a great character.
No, I try to find something that I like, that I'd like to watch. And so use that in whatever the format has to be. And there's a lot of similarities in formats because, you know, television traditionally has lawyers, doctors, and
attorneys, and private eyes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Doctors and attorneys, private eyes. That is, you can solve their story in an hour. And for a long time, networks did not want serialized shows, of which almost all of them are these days, certainly to a great extent.
Yes. But now, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. No, what usually if I know I'm going to be doing something in a genre, because somebody wants that or we think we can sell it or whatever it is. So I try to find a character that amuses me, that I like, because that's when you can have your best time and I think you get your best result. You know, I've had a couple of shows that I've done where I like the characters, but I had casting problems, as per Fred, and they didn't work. I think a couple of them got sold, but it just didn't happen.
Casting problems, as in you couldn't find the right actor to play the role? You couldn't find somebody who really fulfilled it in the proper way?
Well, a couple of times, what happened was I compromised. You know, you're down to the wire. One, we were like shooting 2 days from now. We were all set. And the network and I couldn't agree on anything because once I got functioning, my understanding was that I won't cast anybody you don't want and vice versa. And we usually had to find somebody that worked all right. But in this case, I took somebody that I had real reservations about. And I don't want to mention his name, but he wasn't a big star either.
He just didn't really work out then.
Didn't work out. He wasn't bad. It just didn't work.
Not everybody can play every role. Let me ask you about the turning point in your career. When did you reach a point where you realized, hey, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it with this profession. I'm good at it. And I've got the wind at my back right now. I got a good tailwind and I'm going to make it in this business.
Well, a neighbor of mine was the producer of My Three Sons. And he'd read some of the stuff that I'd written for the album and this and that. And he was producing the show and he gave me a shot. And, you know, he really helped me a lot. I mean, I can't say I totally invented the script and all of that. He really mentored me into getting through it. On the basis of that, I got an agent, MCA, which was the major agency in Hollywood at that time. And they put me on to the Bob Newhart show. And the show was an actual success. I won the Peabody, we won the best show, and were canceled all within a week because NBC wasn't getting the demos that they wanted. So then for the next couple, 3 years, I kind of bounced around. First of all, MCA as an agency went out of business. They were vast. But Bobby Kennedy went after them when he was running the Justice Department, saying he invoked the Clayton and the antitrust laws, saying since Universal now had an agency and a studio, you cannot be the buyer or the seller. So they went out of business overnight. Agents were running all over, making new little agencies and trying to get themselves together. And the agent I'd been with at MCA took me on. And so he'd take me out to these places. I really didn't know that much what I was doing, you know, getting dramas put together and that. But I got
Was that when you were getting an agency to back you, an agent to back you? Is that when you knew?
No, I had the agent. I mean, I still wasn't totally sure because now people would see me because I had the Bob Newhart credit. And I'm young and I don't cost much. Before this, you know, I'd go into an office, there'd be six guys waiting to go into pitch their service. I'd be bouncing around and he'd get me these peculiar jobs like Leo McCarey, fabled, famous, many Academy Awards, comedy director, took me on and hired me to work on a story with him. And as it turned out, he was at Fox, which had been sort of his home, and that at Paramount. And Richard Zanuck, who was the son of Daryl Zanuck, the labeled, you know, fabled producer to head of studio. Once the old man was gone, the son who delivered papers as a kid, Leo McCarey didn't want to talk to him, but he's running the studio. So Zanuck wanted to get rid of him, but he couldn't quite do that. So Leo was trying to get a project together. He brought me in. I later found out he was paying me out of his pocket because the studio wouldn't pay for anything. Then I did an ill-fated thing with a very well-known director, writer, producer named David Swift. And that didn't work out very well. So I'm kind of out there and I'm going into meetings. But then the man from Uncle was having a very hard time getting writers to do the show. There's only a few episodes left. The show was doing okay. It was going to get picked up, but it wasn't a huge hit. So anyway, and they'd been through every writer in town, so they agreed to see me. And they also, you know, Bob Newhart. So I go in and I work with the story editor. I was there for an entire day working on this story idea with him. And the producer creator of the show, Sam Rolfe, came in and said, so what are we doing? And so I tell him what we're doing. And he said, well, you know, you could do this. And I said, well, yeah. And all of a sudden, we're collaborating on this story. So I wrote the show. It was Barbara Feldon's first television show, directed by Joe Sargent, who went on to become an extremely heralded director. I did the show. It goes on. It's like everybody happened to see this episode. All of a sudden, my agent's getting phone calls from everybody. And so all of a sudden, it's like somebody turned on the lights. And actually,
what happened with the script, though? I mean, that particular script, why the excitement about it? What did you do? You obviously changed the tone of it in some way.
The humor. I've always tried to have a vein of humor in shows that I've done. I wanted to be a comedy writer.
So you obviously, based on what you just said, you had interaction with actors. To what level would you be interacting with the actors on these programs? I mean, did they want to go over the script with you a lot of the time?
Well, it varied from actor to actor. Some didn't. Bob Bourne and McCallum just took the script and did it word for word. Unless there was an "an" and a "they" that needed to be changed. They just took the script and shot it. It was kind of America. There are a lot of other places where it doesn't quite work like that. But most of the actors that I've worked with have not been difficult about scripts. Even Peter, who was very fastidious about things.
Peter Falk.
I mean, many times Peter would read the script as he's rehearsing, you know. But Peter was very smart. He was a brilliant guy in many ways. And you know, the show wouldn't have made it without him.
Now, I saw an interview clip with you where you said Tom Bosley called you in. Tell that story. You were thinking, oh, no, you know, Tom Bosley and somebody else. This was the Father Dowling murders, I think, yes. or mysteries. Yeah, Tom, did he have to say?
Well, I get the phone. Tom wants to come in and talk about the scripts. I thought, here we go. Because, you know, you could go through this stuff as you're developing and getting a series going. And so Tracy Nelson played his companion, who was a nun. They come into my office, and Tom sits down. We just wanted to come and thank you for the wonderful material you're giving us to do. This I'd never heard in my life. Many times there are guys who would occasionally grouse them about the scripts, but then when the show's over, they say, what a great script writer you were. I think they're worried about another job. That's the only time it ever happened.
That was a great honor. I mean, Tom Bosley did a lot of acting. I mean, he was Mr. Cunningham on Happy Days, Richie Cunningham's dad, and did a lot of acting over the years. That's quite an honor.
He did Fiorello on Broadway. You know, Tom is a star, a very, very nice man. And, you know, how generous, you know, it's like I helped another actor get a job and get a series sort of inadvertently. But I'd sort of stuck my neck out for him. And then...
But he took the time to come to your office. He didn't need to do that. And he wanted to say how he appreciated your writing on the script, that it was a pleasure to act it out. That reminds me, another question that just floated through my mind has to do with how much ad-libbing would go on. Did the actor stick with the script, or did you have certain actors who just decided, I know what you want me to say, but they just would ad-lib in the moment?
Occasionally you would. Guys would, some guys like to filigree, you know, the material a little bit in the way they think their character is, you know, internalized with themselves and they want to do it. The most amusing story about that was that when we did Jake and the Fat Man, Bill Conrad, who was a kind of gruff guy, but a very nice guy, and also very amusing, a very funny guy. We had Joe Penny on the show. He came in. He'd been successful on, this cop show with this other young guy. And we have a little table read. It wasn't that. You just kind of sit around and walk through the script, and everybody gets, they don't know each other, right? So they get to talking. Joe is a very kind of anxious guy, very nice guy. But he was a little anxious. And so we before we start the reading, he says, Bill, I know about the cards. Bill didn't do anything without cards. You know, he prided himself on never learning a script, even on the earlier show, the cop show that he did, Cannon. So we're there.
That's right, Cannon. Yep, I used to watch that. Yeah, he was carrying around a revolver and chasing criminals.
Yeah. He said, I like your show better because I don't have to worry about my weight.
Yeah, I guess when you see the Batman, you know, you lose your job if you lose weight.
So anyway, we're sitting at this table, and we go through the read, and that Joe says, "Listen, Bill, I know about the cards. It's great. It's great. I have no problem with that. But you know, sometimes I like to kind of maybe change things a little bit, and I'll stay on the point, but maybe a little off of the thing." And Bill says, "Uh huh. Well, when you finish, just nod." He's talking about, Joe's saying, I'm going to do a little ad-libbing around in my speeches, and I hope that's okay. And Bill says to him, well, when you finish, just nod. He wasn't listening to his dialogue anyway.
So tell me about, did you have a favorite actor to work with? Was there somebody who was a standout just in terms of how you got along with that person, or how you appreciated the way he effectuated the script?
Well, actually, Peter Falk.
Peter Falk. Oh, yeah, it's hard to beat him, right? He was on the cusp of being a movie star at the time, right? He thought he was going to be a movie star when he took the Columbo role. Was he hesitant to take that role because he thought, no, I'm going to be doing movies instead of TV?
You're actually very correct. I don't know if any people know that, but he'd gotten a nomination off a movie called Murder Incorporated. And he went on to play some pretty big supporting parts, you know, off of that. And he thought he was going to be a star. So when they did, first of all, Columbo was originally a play called Prescription Murder that Levinson and Link wrote. And they got Joseph Cotten and Patricia Medina and an actor named Thomas Mitchell, a classic character actor. And they put it on and they never quite got to New York. But they had the script. So when they came out to Hollywood themselves, they just started doing television movies. It was one of the early ones in 1966. And so NBC wanted Bing Crosby to play Columbo. And a lot of people know that. Well, they held out Lincoln Levinson and they got Peter. But in making the deal, Peter didn't want to be tied into a series. So he wouldn't give them a series option. So the movie came and went. And then in 1971, the studio wanted to put together this wheel. His business manager had gone south with all of his money. He was totally broke. And there was an actor named Wayne Rogers, you may remember from MASH.
Oh, yeah, from MASH, yeah.
Wayne was actually a big-time businessman. He put together $100 million deals and got funding for restaurants with top chefs and this and that. I knew Wayne because I used to play in a half-court pickup game on Sunday mornings at this park.
Basketball?
We were basically sort of the same size. So we're usually assigned to guard each other. He was a nice enough fellow. And I wondered, I didn't know he was an actor. People were always asking him about stocks and things. Like, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. And then I saw him in a movie. Oh, he's an actor over there. He came in and took over Peter's financial life, straightened him out. They got the guy, you know, and they managed to get, you know, a modest amount of money back from him, you know, on the concept that something is better than nothing. And Peter went on to the show. He was getting $26,500 an episode. And my deal was I'd written the pilot script, but they wanted to bring Lincoln Levinson to come back and do the first year of the show because they knew mysteries. I didn't know them. And I said, I think it's a good idea, but I was supposed to come back for the second year. So I had to step off and do McCloud for a year. And then I came back. But
You just triggered something there. You mentioned, well, first of all, I have seen some actors make the mistake of thinking, hey, I'm successful in TV. I'm going to go to the movies. I think David Caruso did that. And then he flopped in the movies. Yeah. And luckily for him, he got with a popular TV series again. He was able to get back on. He had each of those shows, he had about three lines to speak. It was ridiculous. He just put his sunglasses on and say a line or two. And that was the whole role.
Yeah.
It was crazy. Let me ask you about the scripts though. You do a pilot or you're the developer of a series and you write the script for the pilot or maybe the first three episodes. Most TV writers don't write every episode of a series, do they? Because I see different people who get writing credit. For instance, once a series is launched and it's successful, then a bunch of writers start to pile in and say, I'm going to write an episode of this and turn it into the director or producer. How does that work? Is that correct or not?
Well, there's a lot of variety to that, and it has changed over time. Like I say, when I did The Man from U.N.C.L.E., they didn't have staffs. I mean, they just didn't exist. They were all freelancers. There were story editors or producers would work with writers. Occasionally, they'd have a writer on staff to do some rewriting. Most of the time, the producer, which you know, had to do it himself, or the story editor had to do the rewrites. But now they have I wouldn't even call it a system. They have what they call writers' rooms, which I find a little puzzling. I can understand in a comedy, there was a lot of that in comedies. I mean, the Bob Newhart show, they're like 9 writers or 10 writers. They get fired occasionally, but they were a group of guys. They do their own scripts and they do their own rewrites, but they just had it because of the volume of material. And so today the writer's room has taken that model and they have a room full of writers and a producer or a story editor or whatever it is, usually the writer producer. and they sit and they work on the material together. I find that a little odd. It seems to work, but it's just, it's very alien to me.
You know, let's go to the Dick Van Dyke Show. Remember, he was a comedy writer, and they're in a room, him, Maury Amsterdam, and who is the blonde woman who is in there with them? And it doesn't matter. People would remember it, but they what they did is they sat around trying to think up funny things, and they were sharing jokes and all that. Is that anywhere near reality for, say, when people are writing for SNL or just a comedy show out there? It's people in a room all brainstorming?
They're all different. I mean, I don't know how each of these shows work. I know there are some shows where everybody's in the room. I know Chuck Lorre, who's probably the most successful comedy writer in history, when they were looking for somebody to come on the show on staff, they'd say, what do they have to expect? He said, well, I need big jokes at midnight. I mean, you're going in there and you're there, you know. I don't know how they parse out the work exactly, but there's a lot of interaction. And if nothing else, with the guy who's running the show. One of the problems that's happened in time over television is that there's been what they call a proliferation of credits. There's so many producers. I saw a show not long ago, I don't mention it, but there were 17 producers on the show. They once made a pilot, comedy pilot, it was a half hour, had 17 producers on it. So the Producers Guild forever has been trying to get a minimum basic agreement like the writers have and the actors have. But that well was poisoned back in the 30s when everybody could be a producer. You don't want to do this job? Okay, give me Harry. You know, I mean, he'll produce it. He's been my nephew all his life and I love him. And that's why the writers first struck. It was a big deal because nobody could guarantee their credits except the Writers Guild was formed, but they protect their writers. But they have a minimum basic agreement. They have a contract with the producing association. And there was no such thing for the producers. Anybody could just, you could put anybody's name on it. And so that was...
It didn't really mean anything. Even today, my understanding is if somebody's listed as a producer, it's the executive producer that really holds a position of some authority and esteem. Is that right? Because a producer is just a courtesy for a lot of these actors who, like, you know, Brad Pitt is one of the producers of the movie. Well, what does that mean?
We don't know how much he produced exactly. Well, the Producers Guild has a set of definitions of what titles could go with what functions and how many functions you could have that is getting the credit. And so what they came up with was a name called the showrunner. Because there's so many credits, you don't know what anybody did. Somebody, maybe the actor's agent, maybe somebody's relative, or somebody who owned the material. It could be anybody. So that's where that term came from. Because otherwise, nobody knew what anything happened. And
so back when they didn't have staffs, a lot of the shows didn't have staffs, and they would just use freelancers. Didn't that make it difficult to have any continuity to the show? Because unless they had kind of outlined how every show in the series is supposed to, what it's supposed to accomplish, writers are coming in and just, you know, they understand what the show is, so they write a script for it, but it doesn't necessarily have continuity, correct?
Well, yeah, that's true. And I think that's a problem sometimes. You can even see it. I remember I watched a Dexter episode where John Lithgow was, Dexter was trying to catch him. And he insinuated himself with his family. He was there for Thanksgiving. Everything falls apart. And they wind up having a fight where he's got a knife over John Lithgow. In the next episode, there's no mention of this. There's no affect from it at all. So you figure, well, somehow in the rush, they just as well, the curtain's going to go up and they'll just accept whatever we're going to show.
Whatever we throw at them, yeah.
There was an organization, it may still exist, I don't want to demean it in any way, called the Caucus for Writers, Producers, and Directors. It came into being because of what was called then the FinCEN rule, the financial syndication rule, because networks were only allowed to produce a minimum amount of programming. So the studios functioned in as much as they would have the writers under contract that the studios wanted to be in business with. So because of that, the studios had leverage with the networks, and it's very good for the writers because they put them under contract, some of them for a few hundred thousand dollars a year, and, you know, develop a show maybe over that time. When they decided to get rid of the system, one of the producers at a studio said, or executive really said, why do we have to pay these guys so much money to sit around Starbucks? Yeah, which is actually true. So that little miracle went away.
But talk about... Oh, go ahead, Dean, finish it.
So the SynFid rule was limiting the ability for networks to produce and share the profits of series, which they desperately wanted. So they went to Congress and they made a big pitch saying, you know, we just can't make it. We're losing money every minute and we don't know what to do. So we really need to be allowed to produce ourselves. And somebody said, well, what's going to happen to the independent producers? He said, we love and we need independent producers. We can't possibly do this all ourselves. You know, we need these wonderful, experienced, talented people. So they let them produce all these shows. What happened to the independent producers? Unless they went to series and got a job with the network, they're not around anymore. In the year of Perry Mason Returns, the show that I did, which it wasn't a pilot, it was the episode to try to sell the series, there were 252 television movies made that year. 252. Maybe now you'll find 20, 30. And I remember that because Perry Mason, talk about character again. Of course, there's a history to it, but still all based on character. The show that we did, which is the original 2 hour, was the number one movie of the night, the number one movie of the week, the number one movie of the month, and the number one movie of the year. So a character with that kind of sort of beloved background is a home run. And so Fred's genius was saying, let's take Andy Griffith, and let's take Tom Bosley, and let's take Dick Van Dyke, and we'll design a show for them. So my real function of the show was to find a format and a character that would deliver what you sort of expected to see from that performer, but put it in a new venue. And it worked great. I mean, how many shows did we do over that 10-year period? It just got to a point where the demographics sort of killed all of these series ultimately. But they had, you know, they were very successful just for those reasons. I mean, Matlock was canceled by NBC, ABC put it up. Father Dowling was canceled by NBC, ABC picked it up, you know, because they had, I know I'm...
He had a need for content.
I'm starting to go on about this a little too much. But
they had a need for content. That's why they picked it up, right? They wanted that audience, even though the demographics weren't the best.
They weren't the best, but like Father Dowling was taken over to ABC to counter program against Cosby because they know there's an audience there, and they happen to like the show. They thought the show was well written. And okay, they're not going to kill Cosby, but they're going to go out and just stop anybody from coming in and doing real damage to the show. And so that's, they put it on. It went only about not quite 300 episodes.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead. Finish out that, Dean.
I was going to say, although Columbo was the most successful show, Matlock was very successful. That's 198 episodes. It's still on. In many ways, I liked Father Dowling the best, just as a piece of work. I mean, Columbo was a great show, but we did a lot of very kind of amusing and interesting and slightly eccentric episodes on that show. So
Father Dowling.
It felt a little more like my show in that sense.
Was that your favorite one to write of all of them that you've written in your career?
To some extent, well, I can't say. Yeah, well, that and Matlock and Columbo were my favorite.
Those three were in particular. So let me ask you, though, those TV executives that went before Congress, were they perjuring themselves or did they just miscalculate and think that independent producers would be around and would serve their purpose? Or were they, did they know that that wasn't, it wasn't going to be that way, and they basically perjured themselves?
Well, I would say
or can't you answer that question for fear of not getting work again the rest of your life?
Well, I think that they exaggerate.
Yeah, they paint the rosiest picture because they want what they came for. Sure. So talk about the lifestyle of a TV writer. Talk about Dean Hargrove's lifestyle over the years, or at least, yeah, like your version of, I mean, your lifestyle as a TV writer, I'm sure, is different than many others. But was your life, is it an enviable lifestyle in terms of you've got your time is your own? Obviously, you have to work hard. You have to produce. But what's the lifestyle like?
Well, I guess it, I can only talk about mine because it's, you know, everybody's different. But I've had a great life, you know. I mean, I worked very hard. I'm doing multiple shows, you know. I'm up at 6 a.m. with a trainer to keep myself going.
Oh, okay, I want to get into your regimen too. So you get up in the morning, you have a trainer, you work out, keep yourself fit. Yeah. And then talk about the rest of your day. What's it like?
Well, I'm going to talk about when I was really doing the most shows. Because there have been times I've only been doing one or two. But no, I get up in the morning, my trainer shows up, I work out, and then I'm in breakfast and in the car, making phone calls, which is a great part of your day while I'm driving in. I was always about a half an hour or more to Universal from this part of town. And then you go in and it starts right away. You know, you got to take care of a certain amount of business. There's going to be a cut of a picture to look at sometime during the day. There's going to be perhaps a casting session that's going to happen. And you have to find time to work with writers who come in. And because these particular shows, like Columbo or Matlock, they're highly formulaic. And as you get into doing them, you find out we have three basic endings. The end of the third act, I know he did it, but I don't want to catch him. The other one is, I don't know who committed this murder, you know? Or maybe nobody did it. I'm just kidding with that. No, you figure out these endings and you find way to adjust them to the story you're doing that seems to be the most fun. And that takes a lot of time because we used almost, well, I had a couple of staff writers who worked with me on rewrites. But in terms of the story process, which would be myself and Joel Steiger, who you mentioned earlier, they would come in and they pull out the yellow tablet. The Writers Guild, when you bring a writer in, they allow you to have a meeting, present their idea. If you bring them back, that's a story commitment. And what you do is you make a story with an option for teleplay. My point of view was, if I have a story that's worked, I know I'm going to get a script out of it. If the story doesn't work, I don't go further. And as a matter of fact, we, of the years that I did Matlock, there's only one script that we didn't shoot because it was in a location we couldn't find. Turns out there are no military schools in Los Angeles anymore. So that went out the window. But, you know, I'm sorry.
No, so you're, I mean, for the people who, actually, let me back up a minute. When you're on a project, you're doing a series and you need to sit down and write every day. What kind of were you a morning writer? How much time did you spend at it? Did you sit at a desk doing that? Did you like to move around, like go to a coffee house sometimes and sit and for a different, you know, just a different environment to write? What was your writing day like?
Well, my writing day was had many alternatives based on these other things you have to do. But I would always, knowing my schedule, I would mark out a certain amount of time that I'm going to do that. And also, you wind up working till 8 o'clock on the weekend. You wind up working to 8 o'clock on a weekday, and on weekends, I'm in the office from the morning till night, where there are no phone calls or interruptions. And sometimes, you know, you just have to do it.
So it's a lot of, you put a lot of hours in, you know, when you were in the throes of your career, you were putting a lot of hours in, including weekend hours.
Yeah, no, a lot. I mean, it's a,
But you love the work, or did you? I mean, you love the work.
I love the work. Yeah, it's great fun. I mean, it's a, such a privilege to be in this occupation. I mean, you're very well paid. People might say overpaid when you consider the salaries of people who are performing essential and worthwhile occupations. But I had a system that I worked out whereby since our shows were successful and we would get the order for scripts like in December to shoot in July, I'd start scripts going as soon as we got through the season script. I'd start on the new script and I'd have maybe 10 scripts in the work before my holiday, before I went on vacation. Then I'd go off for 3 weeks and live a very expensive and exciting life, traveling around the world, taking my wife to exotic places and bringing friends along, renting, you know, houses on the Amalfi Coast. I mean, it was great. I mean, and I lived it to the fullest that I could. But I always made sure I had that amount of time because you can't do that on another schedule forever.
So what about the, actually I lost my place here. Let me just go back. Oh, you know, just based on what you were just describing, there's a lot of people who want to get in the business. I mean, and the way you described it, it really points to why. I mean, it's a glamorous business. It's a fun business and people, it's a big deal to be able to say, I write TV shows for a living. So many people want to break into the business. What's your advice to people who are aspiring television writers?
Well, I've been asked questions like this a long time. Well, first of all, I say, write an original script. Don't try to write a script for a series that you love, because there are going to be attitudes that you won't know. There may be, you know, internal disciplines that you won't be aware of. And so chances are you may not exactly capture what they need. And there's, because there's so many things going on internally, and you won't get a really fair shot. But if you write an interesting original screenplay and you get people to read it, which is a challenge, by the way, to get people to read anything, if you do that, then people will find you. They'll say that, oh, this guy's interested, or she's interested. You know, let's bring her in and talk to her. I say that. And the other thing I say, you really have to have talent. You have to learn the craft. And you also have to have great resilience. As I used to call it, it's coming out of the corner. You're going to get knocked down a lot. You got to be able to come back and stay with it. And I think that, and probably talent, are the two most important things, because everybody gets knocked down. You know, you look at the most famous filmmakers, and they've had low periods where they couldn't get anything done or made, and then they come back. You know, so those are the things that always come to my mind from my experience, and I believe in them.
So a lot of perseverance. You have perseverance. You have to be willing to stick with it. You're going to get a lot of rejection. That's just the nature of the profession. So there's that. And then what about, again, I lost my place here, but let me just get back there. Have you noticed that on the streaming channels, you watch Netflix or Apple or Amazon Prime, there's so many series now that are based on novels. There's just a ton of them. Why do you think that's the case?
There's just not enough people with original ideas. I mean, there are some, but I mean, you know, this is a very hungry environment. I mean, they're going to be fed all the time. As I've said to people occasionally, I said, you know, you got to be prepared when you're doing a series. Somebody's going to have their hand out about every 8 days for a script. Producing a show is producing a script. For me, that's it. The rest of it can all be taken care of. How well you do it, how good you are in your choices of people to work with, that's something else.
You come up with a great concept, you come up with a great script, and there's people to do everything else. They're to act, to shoot it, to direct it and everything.
Yeah.
And they're hungry for material. Isn't that why they call this the golden age of TV? Because there's so many different, not just networks, but these streaming channels that there's just gobs of content needed. And some of these shows, you know, and perfectly good shows in some cases, shows that I've loved, what's one season and they're gone. They never even do a second season. Now they got to move in something else. What else are we going to give to our audience and stay on top?
Yeah. And we're at a turning point now. Show business is a study in change. Started with guys in a tent cranking a projector, guys in new Nickelodeons in New York. And look what we have now, you know, with all the digitizing and the fantastic technical dimensions and innovations. It's quite staggering when you think about it.
I heard you mention craft, understanding the craft, but I also have heard you say writing is an art and a craft. Suss that out for us. Talk about the two. Why an art, why a craft? What's the difference?
Well, I had one writing teacher, a man named Lajos Egri, which in the 60s, he had a book called The Art of Dramatic Writing. This was the book. It was on everybody's office in that time. And he'd gotten older, and he came over here. He's a Hungarian guy. And when I met him, he was quite elderly. Very nice man. And he had a little ad in the Hollywood Reporter writing class. And I recognized the name, so I went over. And I started working with him, you know, one-on-one kind of thing. And he was teaching the Ibsen well-made play. And the thing he would always say is, I'm going to teach you how to write a well-made play. It may not be any good, but I'm going to give you the form. I'm going to show you this craft, my version of this craft that you should do. And he recommended me for a couple of jobs, which never went anywhere. It was nice. I remember when Lawrence of Arabia came out, I wanted to go see it. I said, may I take you? He said, oh, yeah, I want to see that. So I go there, forgetting that he was almost totally deaf. So I had to sit like in the fourth row of the theater and overpowered by the film visually. It was in the Wilter Theater, a big theater. And I'm watching this, man. I'm just enthralled by this film. And when the film is over, I said, so, Mr. Reagan, what do you think? He said, it doesn't work, because it wasn't his dialectic. And he said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you don't know any more about this guy at the end of the movie than we did in the beginning. Now, what I didn't say to him, that was part of the theme of the movie. When he's getting up to the Suez Canal, somebody's yelling, who are you? Who are you? At the end of the movie, in his Jeep, sand is obscuring him from our view as it goes over the windscreen. But he was a fascinating guy that way. But that's
his book... The author, The Art of Dramatic Writing, I cannot tell you the number of times his book has been referenced in other writing books. He wrote a book that book is constantly referenced. He obviously wrote a very important piece of work there.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like what you're saying is craft has to do with structure. Art has to do with exercising creativity within the framework.
I guess so. I mean, there's an exception to everything, but I think that's certainly what I've always thought, you know, because I was influenced by him.
So what are you streaming and watching on Netflix, Apple, Amazon Prime? What shows are you watching these days? Or maybe name a few that you recently watched that you value.
Well, I see some shows coming back. I've sampled some shows that I just wasn't that. I just the other night watched a movie called Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I remember the movie with Brad Pitt and I think Angelina Jolie.
That's right. Yep.
Totally different premise and all of that. And I thought it was just sort of wasn't for me. And the other movie I wasn't in love with, but at least I understood it. I thought it was clever. In fact, Hitchcock did a movie called Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And none of them are alike. None of them are the same thing. So anyway, I looked at that. And I looked at Yellowstone, some of the shows that are popular. I could never get into Game of Thrones. I have a trouble with made-up countries and all of that stuff. I'm not a fan of science fiction, I guess is what it really is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not science fiction, but you're talking about I mean, that thing was just one murder after another, and fake civilizations and all that.
I just didn't get it. So what I did do is I went back to one of my favorite shows, which was Luther. You remember that with Idris Elba?
I know the name. I don't recall it, though. I'm not sure if I ever actually watched it.
This is a great show. Fascinating show.
And what was it on, or is it on?
Well, it was BBC, and I think I watched it on Netflix, I believe. It was either Netflix or Amazon.
Okay, Luther.
Luther, you should watch one. And there's an actress in it named Ruth Wilson, who's a really interesting actor. And evidently, I've read more about her. She's a very interesting person. She did a stage play. The whole play was 24 hours. It was like a one-man show.
Wow. She's
really interesting. You should try one. My wife didn't like it that much because... it's got a lot of psychosexual stuff in it that's a little too grim for her.
I might have to watch that one alone. My wife's that way too, that she'd probably opt out of that one, but I could always watch it alone. Yeah. It sounds interesting. I love the psychosexual stuff. I mean, to me, it can be really, really intriguing.
It's a great show. Luther's a great show. And the series that I fell in love with was Suits. Did you see that?
We've watched a bunch of seasons of we haven't got all the way through it yet. It's actually reached the point now where everybody's just yelling at each other constantly. So it kind of went a little too far with just the constant yelling at one another. I'll tell you one that I really loved, Dean. I wonder what you think of it. It was the Queen's Gambit.
I love that show.
Yeah. And I'm just hoping they never make the intent was never to make another one, but you know, that's, because I felt like it was kind of a masterpiece, and anything you do after that is going to diminish the work you've already done. But people cave a lot of times because the money's rolled out. And it's kind of like, you know, just like The Matrix, I thought was a great movie. They never should have made the sequels because they were just trash.
I mean,
it was a concept movie. Once the concept's out of the bag, that's it. Yeah. That's it. Yeah, there's really nothing to do with it. You know, we're a little long on time here, but I wanted to ask you, as I said at the top, you're currently working on the radio podcast series called The Trials of Johnny Cochran. And then you're also working on The Trial of Joan of Arc. Talk about The Trials of Johnny Cochran. This is a podcast series, a radio podcast series. What is it all about?
Well, it's about dimensionalizing Johnny Cochran, who is like Mandela to the Black community. And the story would be his, you know, my point of view about biographies, you can either take an instance that illuminates the character like Sunrise at Campobello, or you can, which is one instance that does that, or you could do the life of Emile Zola and do the whole thing, you know, to try to make it work.
So The Trials of Johnny Cochran, you're going to be reviewing the various people he represented and how the trials developed and the outcomes of them?
Well, yes, that's the heart of it. Yeah, apart from his own progression as an attorney.
What about the trial of Joan of Arc?
Well, actually, I was listening to a podcast about Joan of Arc. And, you know, I thought, well, I know all about it. Well, I don't know all about John. There's a whole lot of other things going on. And the detail of it is fascinating because, as you know, it was the British were trying her because she'd been such a pain in the ass, they couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. And they bait off this one village to help capture her. And then they turned the trial over to the French. Because they wanted to, this looked like, well, the French are doing it. It's really not us. And it's a real trial. As a matter of fact, I have a copy of the original trial. And the reason they made a copy was they know they were going to take a lot of heat for this. So they've got a transcript. So you can see these are all like 60 guys, jurists and priests and everything, examining her, cross-examining her all over the place. And she was good. I mean, she'd say the equivalent of asked and answered many times. She was very smart. She was burned at the stake.
Okay, that's what I thought. That's what I was going to ask you. I thought so.
Three times. They didn't want anything that could be left of her that they could put in a box or something and show it off. And my favorite line in the thing, because it was so grisly, the guy, the British guy who was there to supervise the French who were doing this trial, they paid for the trial and all of that. And the executioner, she's being headed towards the stake, says to the British guy who was running, he said, listen, there's a thing I do. I can as the flames are going, before they really hit her, I can kill her so she won't be tortured. And the British guy said, let her burn.
Said, wow.
Well,
vicious.
I've had a couple of things like this, which I've had people biting on it, and then something would go wrong, and then I'd still go on to something else. Because I wrote a treatment on this, and I met with a woman who had been a top executive at Netflix, and then she came over to Oprah's company to run her company, Harpo. I met with her. She hadn't read it. She says, this is a great idea. So now she's moving in, and she's going to take it to Anne Hathaway, who she did a project with recently. I'm getting a call from a woman producer, and I said, she's going to have a lot. I said, you got to have all women on this production. Let's don't kid her out. And so, and she said, great. And without exaggeration, 2 days later, Discovery buys Oprah's company, and they only want to do unscripted television.
Dean, I really appreciate you coming, taking the time to come on the program. You've been really generous with your time, and it's been an honor to have you. You've had a great career. It just amazes me how many of the shows that you have produced or written, I have watched for many hours, and they're still out there. They're still out there and being watched. So thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the program.
Well, listen, thank you. I'm very flattered you're having me on the show with all these very distinguished novelists. So it's been a treat for me, and I'm most appreciative. Thanks a lot, Mike.